Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. Hey guys, 15th of August, and delighted today to catch up with Dr. Ron Daniels, who's a consultant in the NHS in intensive care out of Birmingham and has great experience with our recent viral issue, to say the least. So great to see you, Ron.
Good to see you, Ivor, and thank you for having me on.
Not at all. This is obviously still a really important issue, and it's great to have real experts to discuss it. So maybe briefly, very briefly, your experience and kind of a little bit of background, and then we'll get into the discussion of perhaps this second wave phenomenon.
Of course. And, you know, whilst I and people who look at my posts on social media will know that I'm cautiously optimistic right now about this virus and the risk of any second wave, let's make no bones about it. When this first struck, it hit hard. It hit hard in London. It then, a couple of weeks later, hit hard in Birmingham before traveling to the Northwest and then further. This was a horrific illness. People became very unwell in very large numbers very quickly. We've heard all of those data. I think what we're now interested in is what's likely to happen in the immediate and the distant future.
Yeah, for sure. And maybe just to dwell very briefly, though, on what you mentioned. So I was putting together the final data for 2020 versus 2018 for Europe in terms of excess mortality. And indeed, there's maybe 185,000 excess deaths in the Euromomo countries versus around 140,000 in 18. But in 2018, they were spread over 4 or 5 months, whereas obviously in 20, it was compressed into 4 or 6 weeks, making it much more intense. But in the UK, I don't know if you're aware, I did see an article from 2018 where there was apparently a very severe season and there was talk of 60,000 deaths, though they were modelled rather than accurately measured. 18 was reported, though, as quite severe, but spread out over months.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see these nasty flu seasons coming about typically every 5 to 10 years. And every year, of course, the NHS sees people affected by influenza and parainfluenza. We see people in our intensive care units every year. But most years, thankfully, it's not that common. We might see a few patients in a typical hospital each year. But when we get these bad seasons, these really severe years, then we're going to see both direct deaths from influenza and paraflu. We're also going to see, of course, the indirect deaths. And the indirect deaths, you know, and the excess deaths will include people who didn't test positive but may have had the condition, and of course, people who decided to avoid seeking healthcare advice for fear of contracting the infection. And really, it's been no different during this pandemic.
Right. Very good summary. So then if we do move on to the second wave, and just briefly, the last couple of weeks, I've been putting together some data, and it's been very interesting in Europe in the past 4 to 6 weeks that there's certainly an increase in cases and, to be honest, testing. But when you look at the first impact of this, and it was, like you say, it was quite severe, the cases, there's a huge curve upwards and down, and then the mortality lagging, there's a big curve upwards and down. But what's striking in the last 6 weeks in France, Belgium, UK, Ireland, all over Europe, there's now a big rise in the cases, but almost nothing in mortality or ICU, or just almost nothing. So we've got a wave of cases for sure, or positive PCRs, but we're certainly not getting a wave of actual impacts. But that's the question then, when or why would the impact start rising for a virus that's already passed through the population and taken the susceptible and caused a lot of community immunity? When would an impact start rising, a true second wave?
Well, absolutely. And look, we all agree, wherever we're working and whichever side of the fence in terms of second wave or no second wave we sit, we all agree that this virus continues to spread through the community and we need to continue to take some sensible steps to limit its spread. Testing has increased exponentially in this country and in others around Europe. And the fantastic work that Carl's done at the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine bears out that actually the increased number of cases almost exactly mirrors the increased rate of testing. Now, to come to the question, when would we expect to see the second wave? Well, the incubation period of this virus is somewhere between 10 and 14 days. The period from the first symptoms to people becoming seriously unwell, for those small percentage of patients who do become seriously unwell, is typically about 10 days. So at the outside, you'd expect to see the second wave 24 days after cases started going up. Now, we're about at that point now in the UK, but we have to remember that pubs have been open now for 5 weeks, certainly in England and in other countries. We look at data from France, from Spain, from Portugal, where the community upswing in cases actually occurred some 2 to 3 weeks before the upswing in the UK, and still they're not seeing admissions to hospital. They're still not seeing intensive care admissions. And you quite rightly said, Ivor, you know, deaths are, of course, important and, of course, tragedies, but there's a huge lag between admission to hospital and death for those people who sadly don't survive. These people do not die quickly in intensive care unless they happen to develop sepsis or significant blood clots. They die over many weeks, and it's typically at least a 14, 21 day admission before we accept that we can't save someone from this condition. So deaths, there will always be a lag. What we're really interested in right now and what we should be looking at is hospital admissions and particularly ICU admissions, and we're not seeing them.
Yeah, exactly. ICU, I've always said all along, for what it's worth, that ICU or mortality and accounting for the lags, they're the metrics for a genuine epidemic, an impactful one. Now, hospitalizations, it's a little tricky because I see in a lot of jurisdictions, if someone comes in with a problem like a broken ankle and they're positive, it technically is a COVID hospitalization. So I think ICU directly related to COVID is the first line of reasonable data. And like you say, it's just not appearing yet. Now, the media are interesting. In Spain, there's a lot of talk regionally about resurgences and problems and hospitalizations. But yesterday or the day before, a doctor from Madrid, where there's a huge amount of excitement and fear about this, went on television and said, I'm ICU. And he said, we have single digits of people. So I think there's people on the ground as well that are not even lining up with the media reports. And they're kind of saying, like you're saying, we're really not seeing anything, guys.
Absolutely. And again, no one's denying that we're seeing outbreaks. And that's the normal pattern of a viral infection spreading post-pandemic. You know, we will see outbreaks in populations who've been fiercely isolating and in regions that have yet to be heavily exposed. So we expect to see more cases occur at some point in the southwest of England, for example, which has so far been relatively preserved. But you talk to doctors, and I've talked to all my colleagues in intensive care units around Birmingham, which of course was heavily hit a while ago. I've spoken to colleagues in London, I've spoken to colleagues in other cities, I've spoken to colleagues in Leicester. We're simply not seeing large numbers of cases being referred to intensive care, let alone admitted to intensive care. So either these people are not coming into hospital in big numbers, and we suspect that is the case also from the data, or they're simply not becoming as sick as they were during the peak of the pandemic. And that I can't explain.
Right. Though in a sense, in terms of explaining it, it's exactly what we would expect to see in an influenza or a bad flu epidemic, bad years. This is exactly what we'd expect to see, that there would be, if you measured and measured with PCR, and especially if you hypertest like is happening, you're going to find influenza. This has been published decades ago. You're going to find influenza and coronaviruses all through the summer. No problem if you look hard, but you're not really going to see an impact. So in a way, this is exactly what you would expect from historical viral epidemics, I guess.
Yeah, it is. And there's other theories that we could apply to this. We could say that the most vulnerable were likely to have been hit hard and had their severe reactions to this SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus early on. Viruses do mutate over time, and the natural behavior of viruses is to become less virulent, less angry, if you like, less effective at killing their hosts. Now, it might be a bit quick for that theory to have become plausible, and some of the genomic studies suggest that that might not yet have happened. And we do need to remember that coronaviruses in general tend to mutate slower than, for example, influenza viruses, but it's still a plausible explanation. You know, the facts are that we are not seeing patients getting sick despite a significant proportion of the population being exposed.
Yeah, and I suppose that's the real anchor baseline fact I suppose people need to internalize. That's the big one. I have a simple list after many months working on this. kind of 7 days a week. But my simple list is for the phenomenon for prior influenzas and for this coronavirus problem. It's very severe. But my simple list is, one, the passing of the susceptible, as you mentioned. Two is a development of community immunity. There's T-cell, mucosal or antibody, whole range of immune responses from the exposure from January right up till now. And then maybe there's a third one, that seasonal effects, the human immune system is more robust in the summer in the Northern Hemisphere. So those three together synergistically, I see as kind of the dynamic primarily that causes how the wave finishes, but you can still see the virus during the summer and in the winter, there's more susceptible people. People have sadly developed cancers and become compromised over the next 6 or 8 months. The season causes a general drop in immune, and the season also causes a rise in the virome. So I think all of this fits with the past. The virus, I agree, the virus getting weaker, especially for coronaviruses, which are, as you said, they're very much less likely to mutate compared to influenzas. I think it's probably down the list a bit compared to the top ones. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I don't think any health professional would sit here and say they can predict exactly what's going to happen in the winter. But I think we have to be really cautious in the light of what you've just said about these Armageddon scenarios that have been put forward of the likelihood of seeing a second wave that's bigger than the first wave or even the same size as the first wave. We don't know what's going to happen in the winter. We may see local outbreaks. We may start to see an increase in the number of cases. But most health professionals on the front line that I've spoken to, having gained their learning over these past several weeks since cases started to increase, is that actually that is really pessimistic. And the likelihood is that we might see a few more cases in the winter, but it's not going to be as horrific as we expect. And we've got to balance that against the unintended consequence. What we are seeing in hospitals now is the horrific aftermath of the mental health impact of this condition on people. People who've neglected themselves, been drinking too heavily, sadly have tried to harm themselves and even take their own lives. Those cases are coming in thick and fast, and we have to balance action against COVID-19 with these unintended consequences.
Yeah, absolutely, Ryan. I mean, and they're enormous. And the misdiagnoses of stage one that may become stage two or three, the huge lags in people getting medical care where they need it or they're going to worsen. You could go on all day. There's enormous collateral damage, which I don't think it's not really getting measured because we seem to be corona or nothing is the strategy. But that's the times we live in. I could be a little provocative on the so-called second wave. And I know we got to be careful what we say here. But my perception from all I've learned and I've read books from Hope Simpson, that brilliant UK doctor who set up the first transmission laboratory to explore transmission in 1933 and spent 50 years in this problem. And I'll put a link to a PDF of his book at the bottom of this. But all the stuff I've looked at, my perception is, if there is a winter resurgence with the most at risk, aged and comorbid at risk in the winter, let's say, right now when there's no real impacts, you could almost see it as a safe spread season where you're building more community immunity, more T-cell, more mucosal, whatever. And maybe the best thing you can do to protect people in a few months' time is to have safe spread now, which ironically would mean that all the lockdowns and the suppression may actually put people at risk when this comes back in winter. That would be a huge irony because you've got all the collateral damage, societal damage, economic damage. The next or the generations coming are thrown under the bus in a way with the devastation. But you also might, by these measures, be making even the corona issue worse in 6 months' time. That's kind of a scary thought to me.
Yeah, and I agree. There's certainly something in what you've said. And of course, all the way through this process, there's been the delicate balance. And right now, it's what do we do with the vulnerable people, those who've been shielding? And I would agree with you. If we allow community-based immunity to build in the well over the next several weeks, we expose people to this virus. They may technically test positive in a couple of weeks' time, but it's likely they're shedding viral fragments by then rather than being truly infectious. Then we probably should allow our shielding to emerge before the peak period of the winter, when it might be safe for them to contract the virus, and when also we might have capacity in the NHS. Of course, the balancing argument to that is, well, we might have a vaccine, but, you know, let's be clear about this. A vaccine, even if the entire population was immunized against COVID-19, vaccines do not absolutely prevent you contracting a disease, nor do they absolutely prevent you becoming ill as a consequence of that disease. In general, what vaccines do is to diminish that illness, diminish your chances of your body mounting a severe immune response to it. And that's a good thing, but we've got to have huge uptake of the vaccine for it to be effective. So it's not just about Oxford or Russia or whomever else developing a vaccine. It's about rolling it out, having public acceptance of that vaccine, and then accepting that some people will still get sick despite it.
Yeah, holding out for the vaccine seems like it's an unusual strategy, I would put it that way. And in terms of effectiveness, yes, we know we have published papers. I have a 2007 one, and people generally have an awareness of this, that the influenza vaccines have limited impact. You know, they're certainly worth trying and they may mitigate. But there's one paper that looked at the last 28 years of influenza vaccines and excess mortality in the elderly, and actually barely got a statistically significant impact when looking at 28 years of data, where the prevalence of vaccine went from 5% to 60%, you know, in populations. So, you know, it'll help. But like exactly like you say, it's not a panacea that you hold out for. The other thing is the origins of the second wave belief system, I call it cheekily. It's a belief system, but it goes back to 1918, really. Now, Hope Simpson and many others have written and published papers on this, and generally the consensus is that the spring wave that was severe but not too bad, the second wave in autumn, out of season and hit a completely different demographic of young, healthy men. There's a broad consensus that that was an unusual event and a different virus from the spring. Either an 1870s virus that came back and hence spared the old because they had prior immunity and hit the young. Or it could have been a major mutation because influenzas do mutate. But in any case, none of the 1918 second wave phenomenon really scientifically connects to this coronavirus. But it seems to be the driving force behind the fear. It's the one proof point that's not a proof point. Or what do you think of that one?
Yeah, and I just want to build on this vaccines point for, you know, what we're not saying, neither Ivor or I, is that vaccines are point. Vaccines are incredibly useful devices in mankind's fight against infection. You know, they've eradicated some really horrible diseases by building a population that largely has a degree of immunity. The point we're making is that they're not fully effective, and they're not. It's not the case that we can give a vaccine to my 80-odd-year-old father and he definitely won't catch coronavirus. It's naive to think that way. And similarly, it's naive, as you say, to compare this to the 19 Spanish flu. This is a coronavirus, not an influenza virus. They behave very differently. And thankfully, this coronavirus, although it has caused some serious illness in younger people, generally doesn't cause such serious illness in younger people. And so that second wave that was seen in 1918-1919 season is unlikely to happen here. Some of the flu viruses do seek out younger people. They do seek out pregnant women. Those characteristics are not seen in this COVID-19 pandemic in any major way.
Yeah, and that's been a huge kind of positive side. I know it's very impactful, but like the lack of young, the lack of pregnant women. I even saw in New York back in March, April, they randomly tested pregnant women in a maternity ward in New York, like I think hundreds, and they got 16% PCR positive, all asymptomatic. So like even back then, and from the China data, we knew the demographic that was going to get affected. So that's a good thing. The other thing, vaccines, very good point. I mean, I got all the vaccines, and even a few years ago going to Shenzhen, I got a bunch of vaccines. I don't even know what they were for. So I just take them because they're a mitigation, you know, whatever. But for influenza, I think it's probably, they're more challenged, shall we say, than in the classics, measles and mumps, rubella, the elimination strategies. You know, they were where they were most powerful. And then for influenzas, they're kind of, yeah, mitigators. So fair point. I'm not sure what else to say about the second wave, except that we're going to have to wait and see what happens. But all of the data, like you say, is flowing in one direction. The science is flowing in one direction. The experience of the 1918 is all flowing in one direction. I wonder why it's so powerful, this perception of a second wave possibility, and why we wouldn't get society working again properly, recover from some of the enormity of the other collateral damage. And then, if a second wave in ICU and mortality really does begin to rise in ICU and mortality, we've got a society now that's ready to put measures into place. So why does it have to be draconian now? Like I won't go into detail, but in Ireland it's unbelievable. They've shut down counties again, and we have no ICU and mortality. What's driving it? Is it fear, mainly?
Hey guys, just a quick reminder that I do need to be supported to provide all of this content, and you can do so at patreon.com/IvorCummins or for a one-off or monthly at PayPal, and you can get that at tinyurl.com/IvorCummins. So hopefully you can help me to continue to provide good, correct scientific interpretation and counter somewhat the biased corporate version of science. Thank you, guys.
I think it probably is. I think, I've never seen a public, a social media user group so polarized on this. And fear and anxiety have been absolutely rampant. And by the way, I think that baseline fear and anxiety is going to result in a mental health crisis in the near future, both in the general public, but also in health professionals. And I think the retention of health professional staff is going to be a major challenge in the coming months. But I think this has polarized people. And of course, what we don't want is people to be behaving irrationally, irresponsibly. We don't want people having mass raves in parks and being extremely close to each other. No one sensible is calling for that. I think what sensible people are calling for is, look, let's accept that the numbers are increasing in the community, that at the moment doesn't appear to be such a bad thing as we've feared, and we do have this opportunity to build some immunity and expose some individuals whilst the NHS can cope. I think that the people who remain very fearful and anxious are concerned that if we spread the message too widely that there won't be a second wave, that the public will just go about a hedonistic lifestyle and behave in a way that none of us believe is sensible during this viral spread period. But I think the pragmatists around this and the people who are perhaps slightly optimistic, and I've been on record saying I don't believe there's a second wave. If we do get one, I will be perfectly prepared to put my hands up and say, I'm sorry, I got it wrong, but I don't believe there's going to be a second wave right now. So as you say, the pragmatic side of me is let's permit the public to enjoy themselves. Let's continue to expect and anticipate and nurture good behavior. But as you say, these draconian measures don't, to me, seem to make that much sense right now.
Yeah, no, that's a good summary, and increasingly draconian in some ways. Like in June, July, when Ireland had no ICU action or mortality in around 6 weeks, and I thought, okay, it's over until next winter. They then brought in mandatory masks, in public transport and in stores, under pain of 6 month prison sentence and 2,500 euro fine. So those are the things that make me wonder as to, what is the actual thought process going on up there? One last thing, actually, there was a phrase about, know people by their actions, not by their words. And I can't remember the exact quote, but I noticed a couple of weeks ago, in the height of the fear around second wave and new mask orders and everything coming in, they began to take apart and dismantle the Nightingale Hospital. So the actions didn't seem to line up. So all the fear of a second wave, and you actually spend millions to fully dismantle your excess capacity while fearing a second wave that might be worse than the first. That's a complete logic implosion, I would have thought.
And so my house is on the military flight path out of Birmingham Airport, and I remember all of those Globemasters and Hercules and Chinooks leaving Birmingham Airport over a period of a couple of days, and it was very obvious what was happening, that they were taking down the Birmingham Nightingale Hospital. I'm going to come back to that, but if I can just say something about masks. I mean, again, neither of us are saying that you shouldn't wear masks. Masks are appropriate to wear when you can't socially distance. Now, if you don't believe the science behind them, that's fine. If you find them a bit uncomfortable, well, so what? If you're thinking about whether or not to wear a mask, think about the fact that the person next to you might be out for the first time they've been out since March. They might be terribly scared, and your mask wearing is out of respect for that individual to help to protect their mental health, as well as potentially reduce the risk of them contracting the virus from you. But to come back to the point, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's pretty obvious. I don't think anyone genuinely sees it as a failure that we built the Nightingale hospitals and didn't use them. We genuinely didn't know how big a problem this was going to come. And a lot of the, not just Westminster predictions and Whitehall predictions, but also military predictions were that this was going to be a bigger first wave than we actually saw. So I don't think anyone can criticize the building of the Nightingale hospitals, but I did find it really interesting that when my ITU was still pretty full of patients, and yes, numbers coming in were starting to come down, these planes were flying over my house, and it was very clear that the Nightingales were being decommissioned. So I think somebody somewhere also agrees that there might not be a second wave, but they're anxious that the public need to continue to behave in a certain way. My view, coming back to the respect point, is simply, let's just be honest about this. We know that whether we're in a pandemic or not, 95% of the public will behave well, will consider others, will be mindful of others' needs and respect others. Let's work on that. You know, let's not be draconian about this. Let's present some evidence. Let's acknowledge what we don't know and encourage people to continue to behave well. Because by and large, the public have behaved brilliantly. And if they continue to do so, then as we've agreed, I don't think there's going to be a second wave.
Yeah, very good. And that's curling very much to a close. I will just mention one thing, which I have to always mention when they talk about predictions. I agree, Ron, that in a state of precautionary principle with unknowns, let's be honest, to build the capacity and to take a lot of draconian actions is completely understandable. And I said that back at the end of March, April. My problem was when we went through the normal influenza curve, the Gompertz curve, it was quite clear what was happening back in April, May, and then things didn't get taken away to get society working again. That's where I had the challenge. But yeah, it makes sense. The only other thing I'd mention is on the inaccuracy of the predictions, I think in fairness, there were many professionals around the world saying that that was out by a factor of 10. They weren't really listened to. And Sweden went ahead with the exact example you gave. They just asked their people to do the right thing. They did. They had no lockdown. They had no masks. Their ICU is down to a handful in 10 million people. Their deaths are gone. And, you know, they had 12 to 17 times lower than the Imperial College prediction. I mean, that's a huge difference. You know, if you see the graph, you've got Imperial College predictions and Sweden is barely along the x-axis. So it's a learning for the future that next time people doing kind of software projections, we're going to have to be a lot better at asking questions about that.
Yeah, and a lot better at measuring and a lot better at being open with our reporting. And also, you know, there's a whole, well, fiasco really around the track and trace and isolate strategy. You know, that could be employed much, much better in future. I think, you know, what I hope comes out of this is we're going to need a number of action plans. We're going to need an action plan if we get another coronavirus, an action plan if we get a really nasty influenza virus, and so forth. And we're going to need action plans that are pre-agreed, ready to activate, but include fluidity. And they have to include the measurement, the testing, the understanding, and the ability to change those action plans over time. No one made in any of these predictions with malice. It would appear that some of the predictions were a little pessimistic.
Yeah, well, 12 to 17 times, just a little. Sorry, couldn't resist that. Here, listen, Ron, I think we've covered the topic and I know you're busy. You're actually on the job now. We are in your office. So I'm not going to take any more of your time, but we might circle back in a while because we're both predicting not a second wave based on the science, based on the history, based on the data, but there's you can never say never. If I said that the moon was going to go into an unusual phase and 10% of people were going to get sick, I mean, it could happen. Anything could happen. But we got to use our rational scientific minds to say, well, what's the probability? What's the right thing to do?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And let's just hope we're right. And I think anyone like us saying there's a second wave, we've got to be prepared, if we're wrong, to put our hands up and say sorry. But at the moment, it doesn't look likely.
Yeah, I think I'll just close with my phrase I brought up 4 or 5 weeks ago. It's quite precocious, but or provocative. It's no second wave without a second virus. So I think from all we know, the way this virus has gone through the population, if we get a second virus, a major mutation, it can have another go at the population, unfortunately. But without that, it's just hard to see scientifically how it could possibly resurge. But yeah. Thanks a lot, Rod.
Thanks so much, Ivor.
Great stuff. Bye now.
Take care. Cheers.
Thanks for listening, guys, and hopefully you enjoyed it. And just a reminder that I do need support to continue putting together all of this content. And at patreon.com/IvorCommons or for PayPal at tinyurl.com/IvorCommons, where you can do a one-off or a monthly support. So I'd really appreciate that, guys, and keep me getting the science out there and countering perhaps the more biased corporate type science. Thank you.